From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, President Trump tweeted out he's watching court cases about raising the age to purchase long guns from 18 to 21 before acting himself. But Education Secretary Betsy DeVos was asked by Savannah Guthrie on the Today Show why the president has been saying he wants to raise the age, then didn't propose it in his plan announced yesterday to fight school violence, kicking it instead to a commission. Here's DeVos with Savannah Guthrie on NBC's Today Show.
Well, the plan is really the first step in a more lengthy process, and the proposals that the president has put forward really encompass a lot of things that are supported on a broad bipartisan basis.
But Secretary DeVos, can I just jump in on that? Because you're saying it's a longer process, and yet the president has made clear what he thought. He didn't act like he had to sit there and think about it and have a process. So why is it that it is not in this plan? What happened? What changed?
Everything is on the table, and the commission that is being formed, of which I will lead, is going to be looking at this issue along with a number of other issues.
And the commission that DeVos will lead is called the Federal Commission Panel to study things like raising the age of purchase. But survivors of the shooting at the Parkland High School, where 17 died, were quick to react to the NRA claims that raising the age would not stop shooters. Here's student David Hogg on CNN.
My response to that is Nick Cruz was 19 and legally bought his assault rifle. It's offensive that they would say that because this would have stopped him.
Nicholas Cruz, of course, the accused shooter at Parkland. NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley is here. Scott, as Savannah Guthrie asked, what did happen? Now the commission might study raising the age, but the president had said this was something he firmly wanted.
That's right. And this was the one area where it looked as if President Trump was willing to defy the wishes of the NRA and back a proposal that the gun lobby fervently opposes. The state of Florida did include a higher age limit in the legislation that was signed into law last week, and the NRA immediately issued a legal challenge. So maybe that was weighing on the president's mind. What we do know is that he seemed sympathetic to this idea, and now it's just in the category of things to be studied.
Well, he's sticking with his proposal to train some teachers, or we're understanding the language of the plan that came out last night, people who want to be trained in schools. Does he elaborate on who pays for screening these people or training them? What do we hear there?
Well, the Justice Department is supposed to work with state and school districts, states and school districts, to help and facilitate this process. There's no pot of money assigned to it, although the White House suggests that maybe the Justice Department could use some existing funding to help with this. The idea is that teachers or other school staff members who wanted to serve as voluntary school marshals could get some additional training and be allowed to carry concealed weapons in the classroom.
All right, we'll see how that unfolds. But, you know, Betsy DeVos, interestingly, in that interview last night on 60 Minutes, said she couldn't imagine her grade school teacher having a gun. But what are some of the other proposals? There's the proposal for a commission to study things, but the president seemed firm on things he wanted.
That's right. Well, he's endorsing two pieces of federal legislation. One is a bill that already has 62 co-sponsors in the Senate, so it's not actually much of a reach for the president. But it would improve the federal database against which background checks would run. It would not, however, extend background checks to gun purchases that are now excluded, including some at gun shows and on the internet. The president's also backing legislation at the federal level that would help states identify and maybe counsel young people who look as if they might be at risk of turning violent early on. Most of the heavy lifting, though, in the president's plan is left to the states. He is urging all states to adopt what are called risk protection orders. That would allow law enforcement to seize the guns temporarily of people who are found through a due process to be a danger to themselves or others. And he is also recommending that states take action to let school teachers carry guns.
Yeah. There are other measures that the president has been calling for that were not in the plan. Banning bump stocks. These are the items that make guns more rapid fire. The Las Vegas shooter used them. As you mentioned, universal background checks. But is there any sense here that the president, in putting this out, you know, anything might be by executive order? Or is, what is the sense? He even derided commissions over the weekends in that campaign rally, you know, air quoted commissions, which just study things. Now he's appointing a commission to study things. Any sense what might come of this?
In the case of bump stocks, the administration has already acted to in the direction of banning those accessories that make semi-automatic weapons perform more like outlaw machine guns. The Justice Department over the weekend issued a draft regulation that would have that effect and gave it to the White House Office of Management and Budget, which is a normal step in the process. So that is in the works, and that's why that was left out. Mm-hmm. Of the agenda that was rolled out by the president last night, but the rest of it is more or less left to this commission to study it. And as you say, the president himself has kind of derided commissions as the refuge for politicians who want to look concerned but don't want to take the risk of actually doing anything.
Well, is there a timeline with his?
No, there is no set timetable for this commission to produce recommendations or even produce a report, although Secretary DeVos did say she expects to act with some urgency. She said there's no time to waste and that no other school should have to go through what the folks in Parkland did.
NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, tomorrow is Election Day in Pennsylvania's 18th Congressional District. Conservative Republican state lawmaker Rick Saccone is being challenged by Democrat Connor Lamb, a 33-year-old Marine vet who leans right in a district that's a mix of wealthy suburbs, industrial towns, and rural communities, and is about 90% white. It's a special election to fill the seat vacated by retiring Republican Tim Murphy, and it's being looked at as yet another bellwether for the upcoming midterm elections. It's also a toss-up. An Lee Herring from member station WESA in Pittsburgh has been out talking to voters in the district.
Pennsylvania's 18th congressional district has been called Trump country. In 2016, the district went for the president by about a 20-point margin. But Westmoreland County Commissioner and Republican Chuck Anderson will tell you that this special election is no sure win for the GOP. Anderson says his constituents on the eastern end of the 18th are thoughtful voters.
They look at the people, they look at the issues, and they vote them. They don't just go pull the D or the R lever. They think about it and actually split their vote.
I'm a registered Republican, but I haven't been too happy with a lot of things that have been going on.
That's retired school teacher Patricia Pluck. She says she hasn't voted for a Democrat for at least 10 years, but will do so in this special election. She's disappointed that her party hasn't tried to compromise with Democrats.
They seem to be, like, not wanting to cooperate, not wanting to try to find a compromise.
Pluck thinks Connor Lamb could bring a new balance to Capitol Hill. I found a good number of undecided voters at a fish fry at St. Anne Church in Waynesburg, PA. Among them, Sam Boyd. He's spent most of his life here, in a rural area in the southwest corner of the 18th, where once coal was king. The retired construction engineer is a Democrat, but wears a baseball cap honoring President Trump's inauguration. He says Trump needs more help from Congress, and to Boyd, that's one of Saccone's big selling points.
That touches me pretty strong, and I like that about him. Now, but in fairness to Connor Lamb, he said he wants to get down there for the people, not as a Democrat.
Boyd is aware that Lamb and Saccone both oppose additional restrictions on what types of guns law-abiding citizens may own. He says he's a firm believer in the Second Amendment.
I got a gun on me right now. I carry a gun for self-protection.
Boyd expects his choice to turn on which candidate he thinks is stronger on gun rights. For Republican software developer Terry Nick, it's an easy choice. He's voting for Saccone, who Nick says shares his values.
You know, I'm for lower taxes. I'm for lower spending. That's just my philosophy.
Nick recalls growing up in the Mon Valley, where his grandfather settled and got jobs in the coal mines. He says he knows a lot of miners and steelworkers who have tended to vote Republican since crossing over to Ronald Reagan in 1980.
I don't know. The Democrat Party seemed to have left those people. I mean,
in Greene County, many share Nick's concerns, says Republican Commissioner Archie Trader.
Well, you know, we've had several mines closed. We just had another one that's going to close in a couple of months where it's close to 400 people. And, you know, that's a real drab on a small community.
Trader says it's possible that Lamb could win back support from Democrats who went for Trump, given that, like Saccone, he has relatively friendly positions on shale drilling. That extends to neighboring Washington County, says Democratic Commissioner Larry Maggi.
Our economy's energy. Southwestern Pennsylvania is the energy capital of the East. And if somebody comes out against that, absolutely, that's going to be detrimental to their campaign.
Farther north in suburban Allegheny County, attorney Barbara Shaw says a potential Democratic blue wave could benefit Lamb. Shaw and fellow Democrats were alarmed by Trump's victory, but at a campaign event for Lamb, Shaw says she's hopeful they'll prevail with a strong grassroots ground game.
I think the answer is going out, knocking on doors, and getting people out to vote. And I think Connor is going to have the people to do it.
And voter turnout will be crucial. Recent polls show a tight race, with Saccone holding a slight lead in some and Lamb having the edge in others. And election forecasters now rate the long Republican-leaning district a toss-up. For Here and Now, I'm Anlie Herring in Pittsburgh.
Balkrishna Doshi has been called the father of sustainable architecture in India. He's known for work that combines traditional Indian design and modernist principles, an approach he has applied in projects as diverse as an underground art gallery and a low-income housing complex the size of a small city. Last week, at the age of 90, Doshi became the first Indian to win architecture's highest honor, the Pritzker Prize. And Balkrishna Doshi joins us now from Ahmedabad, India, via Skype. Congratulations, and how does it feel to win this award?
Well, absolutely touching, very emotional, and I'm not only surprised, but I'm grateful.
Well, tell us a little bit about your work. The Pritzker Committee said you've always created an architecture that is serious, never flashy, or a follower of trends.
I think the kind of architecture that I do is connected to my own place, the ground. So it has to be rooted, because in the changing and constantly uncertain circumstances, there is no other way but to find connections between small and big and diverse situations. The sun is very hot in certain times. Monsoon comes, you know, and flooding rushes. Then winter is reasonable. Then there are hot winds. But otherwise, if you close the house, it is stuffy. So what one tries to do is almost like clothing. You know, you try to create ways and means of creating projections, openings, enclosures, cross ventilation, so that you really feel always that you would like to be inside rather than outside.
So how much for you is about utility versus the beauty of the place?
No, I would give them equal, because I think if utility is not there, you are not comfortable. And then if you see the beauty, you would notice. But if you see the beauty, but then suddenly the comfort is not there, then I think your attention to that beauty would reduce. So I think you have to have equal balance as much as possible.
I was reading an interview that you did, and you said that the perfect architecture will allow you to really explore your own thoughts in a way that you wouldn't otherwise.
Actually, what happens is that, you know, if you were a child, when I was a child, I was wandering anywhere. You go, you have a sense of freedom, and suddenly you discover something which you had not discovered before. And I think the most important thing is that our subtle nuances in our sensitivities, if we cannot really relate them to the outside or allow them to connect with the unknown, the unexperienced, I think new thoughts don't come, because surprise is one of the very important elements for creativity.
And where did you first experience that?
I first experienced in my grandfather's house, climbing up and down those dark, semi-dark staircases. And then suddenly you come to a courtyard, and then you go to the terrace, and you see a very little plant. And you feel the differences between all these. And then it is quite silent, you know, compared to the street, you know, on which the house is. So you do get this contrast, you know, when there's hot, you sit, you know, in there, and you look at the moonlight. The skies are very beautiful in India. And I think we used to sleep on the terrace. And I think it was very pleasant, cooler, because the wind was blowing. And in a few minutes or maybe 20 minutes, you know, the whole place becomes cool and you feel so happy and relaxed. I think those experiences I try to remember. And then I go back to see buildings in India, the old buildings or palaces and others. And I discovered that they had imbibed these things in their work. They had manipulated the way surprises would happen. If there is a hard sun, how do you get reflected light? If there was a breeze, how do you catch the breeze? Do you find some scoops in the roof? And then the breeze would come down instead of a fan which is hung on the ceiling. Given the situation, how does one highlight or discover and create a situation by which you get what you want without thinking that you will get it? And I think that's the surprise.
You worked with the famous modernist architects Louis Kahn and Le Corbusier, whom you called the guru. How did they influence your work?
Well, they talked to me about life. We never discussed architecture, either with Corbusier or Kahn. Corbusier, you know, I was younger, much younger. And he was showing me how people move, how people behave, how birds and animals go through the house, how shadows happen, what does the sun do. Then he would look at the miniature paintings and look at how our ancient traditions are, where there are beautiful terraces and balconies and jharukhas. And Kahn, on the other hand, talked to me about the shadow, but he talked about the ethereal quality. You know, he would talk about the sun, which hits the wall of the brick, and the brick gets highlighted because the brick is not, it is almost semi-handmade, and you could get the textures of the brick. And I think both became, for me, gurus in different ways. Kahn admired Corbusier because of the ability to dream and explore and do the unexpected. But for me, Kahn also gave me the idea of the immaterial, you know, what was inherent in me in India, which I was not aware. I became aware because Kahn talked about the spirit of the unknown and what that spirit means. You know, he would say, what would the building like to be? What does the brick want to say? And I think all those things combined together is what I am trying to do and then discover myself. Techniques that I find here, like in South India, the columns are not the same. Each column is different, and though they have the same geometric order of structure, and suddenly one realizes the columns also are alive because the statue or the sculpture or the figure starts talking to you. So how can the inert matter becomes alive? And I think they did not think, you know, that you need column has to be only pure and round or whatnot. But here, the columns were exaggerated, you know, by their expressive attitude of almost as if they were living being. And I think these are the kind of elements I learned from India.
You mentioned columns, by the way. There's a project that you did in Ahmedabad, an underground art gallery, and many of us were looking at pictures of it and noticed that it reminded us of Gaudi. Was that where you got that idea, or was it completely separate?
No. It was actually an accident. I was doing this in ferrocement building. And before I was doing ferrocement building, I had thought of putting columns in certain places, which I had done. And I had taken a hollow hume pipe, cement pipe, and I had located them there. And when I decided to use ferrocement, the junctions which came between the walls or the curvature that happened, I think they and the column below did not work now. So what I had to do was find a way. So I found a bamboo stick. And I created the gravity, force of gravity, and created those. And then the column was somewhere else, and I tried to match that with the curvature, which is a little away. So they are actually not functional in a sense, but they are combining now what was before, what is new, and what can be done so something else would come. So even for me, it has been a great surprise.
You also mentioned scale, and I want to ask you about another one of your projects, the Aranya low-cost housing, which is home to 60,000 people. Did you have any feelings of overcrowding while you were putting together something like that?
You know, I also get surprised when I still recollect that there are 60,000 people. But when you start with a blank plate or earth, and then you start doing plinth, when you do plinths, you know, of 50, 100, etc., you don't realize what you are doing. And slowly, these people come and settle there as if they are settling on a slightly raised platform with a little tap and a toilet there. So when that happened, their scales were extremely narrow. If I had taken the municipal bylaws, I would have never done these buildings. But because they had doing their own buildings and nobody was controlling them, they found minimum ways of using maximized utility of spaces. And that's how the scale changed. So today, 60,000 people, you don't notice them because the houses are small houses, like towns. So it's very human. You don't feel overcrowded. And I think that is what I learned again, that if you want to do things, break them into small components. So it was not a combination of one building. It is like having many, many small buildings. Actually, they're all small segments, or like a honeycomb. A small segments put together, then it becomes a big thing.
What's your favorite building that is not one of yours, but anywhere in the world, something that you are inspired by?
I think Fatehpur Sikri, to me, still fascinates me, and the South Indian temple. Fatehpur Sikri, because it is on one single unit, columns, you know, one material, one simple pattern, and almost like a prefab, you know, you get stone slabs and columns, and it grows so beautifully that you always go there, and there is no tree, incidentally, there in that whole campus. But what a beautiful place, because there are a lot of places of shade, and then a lot of variations when you move there, because you are meandering, you're all the time going with the shadow and light, and you are always wanting to be in the shadow, but you have to shift, because the plan is shifting, the building shifts. Then you look at Indian sculptures, Indian paintings, and the way India tries to do traditionally the fulfillment of everything. And I think this is what I learned.
That's Balkrishna Doshi, who is the winner of this year's Pritzker Prize for Architecture, joining us from India on Skype. Balkrishna Doshi, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you today.
No, thank you, Mr. Hobson. Thanks a lot for all this. Thank you.
Television viewers, rejoice. You are soon to be bombarded with fewer ads. Fox Networks Group has announced that it's looking to reduce ad time to 2 minutes per hour by 2020. Joining us to explain this unexpected development is Here and Now media analyst John Carroll. Hi, John.
Hey, Jeremy.
So what's going on here?
So Fox Networks Group has started to reduce its ad time on its on-demand programming, and now it wants to roll it out. This is a goal, to roll it out by 2020 to the Fox Broadcasting Network, where you see shows like Empire, sports channels, and cable channels like FX.
Shorten the ad time. We talked to you recently about Fox's experiments with six-second ads. Is this all part of the same idea?
It is. And basically what they're trying to do is make traditional TV more like digital TV, because that's where the young viewers are. And so what they're doing is trying to move more toward what they call snackable content, which is long enough to get your point across, but not so long as to be annoying.
But trying to get people, basically, even though we have now a world of many places to get your media, to stick with television?
Right, because they're migrating away. And the erosion, what they're trying to do is not increase viewers. They're trying to stop the erosion as much as possible. And they seem to think that advertising is the roadblock for them. So they're trying to eliminate as much as possible.
Is anyone else moving in this direction?
NBC Universal has said it's going to cut ad time on 50 programs, original primetime programs in the fall. So they're looking to do this as well. Whether the economics work or not is a good question.
What about the economics of this, John? Last year, the average amount of ad time on broadcast TV was about 13 minutes. It was 16 minutes on cable. How do you even get that down to 2 minutes and still make money?
Well, it's going to be hard. I mean, they're never going to replicate the revenue they get from ads. Now, Empire, for instance, has 10.5 minutes worth of advertising and pulls in about $6.5 million for each program. So they're not going to be able to get that from two 30-second or 60-second ads. What they're going to do is going to be a lot more program integration, which is where basically the product becomes part of the plot. or there'll be the kind of double boxes we saw during the Olympics where the program and the ad mm-hmm. run side by side. There's going to be sponsorships. They're going to look to alternate sources of revenue. And they're going to charge more for the ads because it's going to be the economics of scarcity.
How's the ad industry reacting to this?
The ad industry reaction, no surprise, is decidedly mixed because they're used to the traditional model. The experiments that the networks are going to be doing are going to be expensive. For instance, Empire, again, Pepsi had in 2015 had a lot of product integration into one of the programs, followed it up with a music video starring one of the characters from Empire. I mean, that's really costly. It's effective, but it's not traditional advertising, but it's really costly, and you can't do that on a regular basis. That's sort of a one-off kind of thing.
When you have news like this, how do you teach students about advertising?
Well, you teach them all the alternative ways that advertisers are trying to reach their reach consumers. So there's a lot of native advertising out there, which is advertising that looks like the editorial content around it, sort of ads in sheep's clothing. They're looking for alternative ways to reach consumers with their message mm-hmm. in the most accessible way possible.
That's John Carroll, here and now media analyst and a journalism professor at Boston University. We've got a link to his Campaign Outsider blog at our website, hereandnow.org. John, thanks.
Thank you.
On Wednesday in Washington, the House will vote on a bill to give schools more money for security, a vote that will take place exactly a month after the mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High in Florida that took 17 lives. But some schools aren't waiting for money from Congress. In Atoka, Oklahoma, town officials have built 6 safe rooms at a cost of $400,000. Gunning Bedford Middle School in Delaware has more than 100 bulletproof whiteboards for people to crowd behind in the event of a shooting. Kenneth Trump, no relation to President Trump. In fact, he disagrees with the president on arming teachers. Ken is a well-known consultant, president of National School Safety and Security Services in Cleveland. We're looking for his opinion on what works. And Ken, we spoke a few years ago with the creator of those bulletproof backpacks when they first came out. They're now selling like hotcakes at gun shows. What's your sense of them?
Well, I always ask if we need a bulletproof backpack, wouldn't we need a bulletproof front pack, a bulletproof helmet, and a Captain America shield? Now, while that is not intended to make light of the overall concerns, it is said to illustrate that the devil's in the details of implementation. And if a child has a bulletproof backpack, how would that function? First of all, most kids don't bring their backpacks to every classroom. They're not going to have a backpack in the middle of the gym while they're learning how to shoot baskets. So we want to focus on practical, proven best practices, things that we know that work, rather than doing some surface level things that may make us feel like we have an emotional security blanket, but really may not make us feel safer.
What about the whiteboards? I mean, people can make the case that rather than trying to crowd into closets, which many classrooms don't have, at least they could get behind the whiteboards.
Well, again, let's think about how that would work. You have a classroom of 26 children and a whiteboard that's maybe 3x5, 4x6, whatever the size may be. Are you going to say, okay, all 26 of you line up in a very, very straight line now? Your life depends on this, and are you going to be able to do that in the chaos of an unfolding situation? So again, I question the practical aspect of how this would work, and what we'd really rather focus on is really looking at the human aspect of this. Really, school safety and these critical incident responses come down to people and procedures, and I think we see that discourse after every high-profile shooting. Were there warning signs that were missed when people had some knowledge ahead of time? So these are where we really can make schools safer, but unfortunately, some of these incidents still will slip through the crack because we're dealing with human behavior.
Well, but we still want to touch on some of the things that people are proposing outside of that, and that includes President Trump proposing arming some teachers. Now, you are against that, and we've covered this with others. The many reasons include, how does responding law enforcement know who's the teacher and who's the shooter? Is the teacher going to carry a loaded gun that a child might wrestle away from them and use? All the different reasons we've heard that people are against that. You are too. But you have talked about improved training of everybody, teachers, parents, custodians, food service workers, You don't mean in gun usage. You mean in what?
Absolutely. We don't mean in gun usage. Look, this is certainly, there's an aspect of firearms where there are Second Amendment considerations, concealed carry considerations that people may support from a personal family level. But when you're talking about arming teachers and support personnel, you're talking about tasking educators, laypersons, to perform a public safety law enforcement function. And we'd prefer to see a trained professional law enforcement person do that, not only because of their skill in a firearm, but more so the mindset and training. So what do we know that works, and what do we focus on in schools that educators can do? First of all, we know that the number one way we find out about a weapon or a plot in school is by a kid who comes forward and tells an adult that they trust. And many schools focused on that very consciously and in direct communications and work with kids on that after Columbine, and it did improve our reporting and thwarting of incidents.
Yeah. Well, we hear this over and over and over again. The more you heavily arm a school and militarize it, the less likely kids are going to be feeling that they can come forward. It starts to feel punitive, and it starts to feel like they can't cross that armed line to go tell somebody what they've heard.
Well, this is really important. Think about what schools are. And are we going to extend that type of hard physical security, hardened target type efforts to a corporate or government facility security model to a school? Are there ways that we can tighten security and improve some physical security aspects, access control, visitor management, cameras, and other matters? Certainly we can do that. But how are we going to strike a balance?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned some other techniques, because if you Google around just a little bit, there's a bit of a debate within your community, the safety community. For instance, there's the training program called ALICE, Alert, Lockdown, Inform, Counter, Evacuate. They have called you out, saying that you are less likely to recommend any of those things. You're mostly a lockdown guy. So when there's even a debate within the security community as to which program is best, it gets very confusing. I mean, would you say never counter?
Well, what I would say is that their model, as well as the run, hide, fight model that's put forth by the federal government,
sure,
have actually been promoted and encouraged by many times by people who aren't K-12 school experienced, who don't have focus on a child-oriented concept. Certainly, we know that lockdowns work.
As opposed to evacuating.
The vast majority of cases, lockdowns work. However, think about what you're talking about, first of all, with self-evacuation that those two models advocate for. And we only have to look as far as Parkland, where the evacuation process occurred, in that case, by the student who pulled a fire alarm to lure them out. You are leaving a secure location. It could be running into the line of fire, and it could be certainly delaying law enforcement. If you have hundreds of kids running out or thousands, and you have the police, fire, and EMS rolling up on scene, how do you get to the active shooter, to the person to neutralize them? There are some serious questions to be asked.
Look, Politico reports that 2 days before the Parkland shooting, the Trump administration proposed cutting millions of dollars from programs that pay for school counselors, violence prevention programs. You know, many people oppose these cuts, including you. Is this where you think the solution is, this idea of finding the troubled young person through counselors and programs before a gunman is in your school?
We need to have a balance of mental detectors and metal detectors. We know that many of the warning signs are there. We know that many of our second and third grade teachers can identify those children who are at higher risk to commit violence. The question is, what do we do with those? When that teacher refers that second or third grader to the office and the principal has no counselor, a school psychologist who's only accessible to maybe a dozen schools at any point in time and has to schedule an appointment a couple of weeks out while they're also focused on testing and administrative tasks, what do you do for that kid? And what do you do with that kid if the family dynamics play into that child's needs? So I think you send them back to class when you don't have those resources, and you repeat that same process and then wonder why they erupted in middle school or high school. So I think as far as the federal programs that cut, it actually goes back farther than that. After Columbine in 1999, which you'll note is almost 20 years ago, Clinton administration at that time in a Republican Congress took a bipartisan approach and put programs in place with Safe Schools, Healthy Students to get some mental health and training in, and resources and programs into schools. And those programs were effective. They were evaluated. Information was shared with other schools across the country. Well, those were chipped away during the Bush era and completely eliminated in one of the only bipartisan moves I've ever seen by the Obama administration and Republican Congress, who decided for some strange reason to completely eliminate them. So these are things that, among many other best practices that worked, and we know from lessons learned after Columbine, then we have to get that information out to our well-intended educators who are getting conflicting information. You know, school safety has been politically hijacked on gun control and gun rights. It's been seized by the Security Industry Association for selling products and hardware, and it becomes a competing interest agenda and a battle over who has skin in the game and who can profit in one way or another to advance their cause or their interest without really focusing on, from a professional level, on what's best for kids in schools.
That's Kenneth Trump, the president of National School Safety and Security Services, a consultant. Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you.
More than 2 months after Republicans passed that $1.5 trillion tax cut, there are a lot of questions about how the law was written. The Chamber of Commerce has asked the Treasury Department to clarify how the law impacts multinational corporations, among other things. There's some concern about how farmers are taxed under the law and what is being called the grain glitch. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us, as he does each Monday, from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
And we'll get to the grain glitch in a second. But first, The New York Times reported on a number of errors and issues with the tax law over the weekend. What's the problem?
The problem is the tax cut was written extremely quickly, and it was finalized in a desperate attempt to get the president to sign it in December so that it could go into effect this year, 2018. The Times likens it to a blitz. I would prefer to liken it to like a college sophomore cramming on a philosophy paper until 3 a.m. And when I did that as an undergraduate, I made a bunch of mistakes in those papers. Mm. There were typos, there were lazy inferences. And it turns out that politicians are basically just like undergraduates in this respect. When they write legislation at 2 a.m., they make a bunch of mistakes. And what's happening now is you have a lot of companies and lobbying groups that have had a chance to review the law, to grade the law, and they've come back with their grade, and the grade they're giving is essentially an incomplete. They're saying these politicians, the Republican Party in particular, with the help of Democrats, they need to go back and finish this thing because the law as written is a mess that has a lot of confusing provisions or downright backward provisions for agriculture.
And then let's get to the grain glitch. What is that?
So one of the last-minute edits to this bill was a provision that allows farmers to deduct sales that they make to co-ops, cooperatives, so, you know, food and agriculture organizations that are co-owned by farmers or other members. So what's the problem with that? Like, I've got a co-op down the street from me. It's pretty good. But essentially, this gives farmers a huge tax cut, possibly making some of the largest farms in America completely tax-free. And just as importantly, it's destructive for any agricultural business that's not a co-op because the provision was only put in for sales to co-ops. And so you have a lot of people in the agriculture business that are essentially saying, you can't do this. You are – first, you're making some farms completely tax-free. And also, you are disadvantaging every agricultural business that is not a co-op. And so we need to fix the law.
Now, the problem with fixing the law, according to the reporting on this, is that any corrected legislation would have to go through Congress and get support of Democrats. You write, Derek Thompson, that aside from some of these smaller issues, the narrative about the tax cut is unraveling. What do you mean by that?
So I think Republicans like Paul Ryan marketed this law as principally a middle class tax cut. And what Democrats and liberals said back in November and December of last year is they said, look, this is a 10-year law where the middle class does get tax cuts at first, but those tax cuts get smaller over time and the benefits to corporations are permanent. And in the weeks after the law passed, if you recall, there was this bonanza of bonuses that made it seem like the Republican narrative was absolutely right, that this tax cut was flowing directly to workers. But now with a bit of perspective, it seems like the liberal prediction is coming true ahead of time. The key stat here is that stock buybacks in the first 6 weeks of the year were 28 times larger than the total value of end-of-year bonuses credited to this bill. So essentially what you're seeing is that, yes, there are some middle-class tax cuts that we're seeing, and you know we shouldn't lie or fudge about those, but at the same time, the benefits to corporations are so much larger than the benefits to workers, and that is essentially the opposite of what the Republican narrative was.
Now, Republicans are still arguing that the tax cuts are a success. Here's Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, at a Home Depot support store in Atlanta last week. He said tax reform has led business to invest more and optimism is high.
But I think the thing that we're so excited about is the family relief. The fact that if you have kids, your child tax credit goes from $1,000 to $2,000. The fact that rates are across the board going down so that you will have seen in your withholdings a bigger paycheck. 90% of American workers are getting more pay as of February because of tax reform.
And Derek, people are starting to see more in their paychecks, right?
There's no question. People are starting to see more in their paychecks. And partly it's because of a low employment rate and a tight labor market. But also, in due credit, it's because of this tax bill. There is a middle class tax cut in this tax bill. But it is a temporary tax cut that right. fades over time. And in the long term, this is essentially a permanent tax cut on corporate rates. And essentially, the argument there is that those rates, those tax cuts are going to trickle down. But I do not think that economic history or economic research actually supports that conclusion. So my objection to Paul Ryan's description of the law here is not that he's lying about the tax benefits that Americans are seeing today, but when he says the thing we're so excited about is the family relief, it's important to remember that this tax bill was written explicitly so that family relief would be temporary, but the benefits to corporations would be permanent.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
And a note on taxes from Kansas, where they passed those huge tax cuts under Governor Sam Brownback that led to a budget crunch and lots of cutbacks at schools. They were repealed. Well, now some Republican lawmakers in that state are pushing for a new tax cut for businesses. We'll keep an eye on that. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.